let's begin with the franchise tag. Deadline was yesterday to do any sort of extension. Dak Prescott, it only becomes only the third quarterback to play under the franchise tag. Drew Brees in 2005, Kirk Cousins twice he did it, 2016 and 2017. And there, the stats that came out that were released of, okay, well, the year that those two quarterbacks signed it, they got worse. There was the record got worse. The stats dropped a little bit. With Dak Prescott, should there be any concern of that with how loaded that offense is, including you had CeeDee Lamb, who was one of, if not the best rookie prospect at wide receiver coming out of the draft?
Well, this is one of the reasons why Dak Prescott signed the franchise tender several weeks ago. He could have held out for all of training camp, all of the preseason, if there is one, and then shown up a week or so before the start of the regular season and got his full $31.4 million. You know, there's a sense in league circles that Prescott shouldn't assume the Cowboys will tag him again next year because he gets a 20% raise and that number shoots from 31.4 to 37.68. But the easy response to that is, look, the Cowboys decided to use the highest possible level of the franchise tag this year to keep Dak Prescott on the roster, to slam the door for any possibility of another team offering him something that the Cowboys wouldn't be able to match, and then the Cowboys would get two first-round picks. That's the basic franchise tag approach. They could have saved $4 or $5 million. They went all the way to the top, the highest possible level. They want this guy on the team, and I think it's going to take a catastrophic injury or a dramatic reduction in his performance to get the Cowboys to reconsider that. And, you know, as you said, the offense is loaded. They've got CeeDee Lamb. They kept Amari Cooper. They have Ezekiel Elliott. It's hard to envision a guy who hasn't missed a game in four seasons and who has been a very good quarterback all of a sudden not being very good and putting the Cowboys in a position where they don't keep him next year at $37.68 million. And that's important because when we get to next year and it's time for them to try to do another long-term deal, the starting point is $37.68. The price keeps going up. The longer the Cowboys wait to sign into a long-term contract, the more and more and more expensive it gets, and the harder it gets for them to do that deal.
Will a potential Deshaun Watson contract extension have any bearing on what Dak will end up getting from the Cowboys?
No, because Dak's future now is determined by the franchise tag. 31-4 in hand, 37.68 next year. That's what sets the floor for his long-term contract once the Cowboys get to a point where they can negotiate with him again after the season ends. Deshaun Watson is hopeful to get simply a three-year extension onto the 2 years he has left with the Texans. This whole Patrick Mahomes 12-year deal is an aberration. Quarterbacks want shorter-term contracts. They want to get back to the table sooner rather than later, and that's what Watson is going to try to do, much like what Russell Wilson always does. Wilson does four-year extensions and keeps his options open as long as possible. That's what Watson's going to look to do. So his situation, I think, very different from Dak Prescott, because Prescott at this point is driven by the franchise tag and what his future would be. And what's looming for Dak and the Cowboys is exactly what happened with Kirk Cousins after he was tagged twice. What do the Cowboys do in 2022? They can pay him $45 million, $54 million, or let him walk away. Either way, it's not a good situation for the Cowboys to be in, and it's all because they waited too long to get him signed to a long-term deal.
In conversation with Mike Florio from NBC Sports Pro Football Talk on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. Mike, how about Derrick Henry? 4-year extension, $50 million bucks. But I said at the top of the show, what fans need to realize is saying, oh, he's 26, 4-year deal, that magic 28-year-old number. When a running back hits that, he's 26 now. You follow the guaranteed money, right? The $25.5 million. I don't know the term when that's all up. I would guess it's probably after year two. What did you think of the Derrick Henry deal overall? And obviously, he is the key piece to that offense for Tennessee.
Yeah, we got the full breakdown yesterday, and we have it posted at profootballtalk.com. It's $25.5 million fully guaranteed over the first two seasons. And when you look at his franchise tag of $10.2 million, the 20% raise he would have gotten next year, he would have made $22.6 million over the next 2 years under the franchise tag, and there's no guarantee he would have been tagged next year because of the position he plays. He's got a very punishing running style, and he only took 59% of the snaps last year offensively. While the Titans were willing to do 10.2 this year, come next year, if the salary cap goes down, as some think it will, if his production dips at all, they may not have been willing to go $12 million plus to keep him around. Instead, he gets $2.9 million more than he would have gotten in 2 years under the franchise tag. It's fully guaranteed, not just injury guaranteed, so he's going to get that money. And what he had to give up was two more years with the Titans if they choose to keep him around beyond the next 2 years. But it really is a two-year contract with then an option for the team to continue into 2022 and 2023. And, you know, if he's playing at a high level, they'll be happy to pay him the $24.5 million he's due to make on the back end of the deal.
Yeah, seems like a smart deal from all parties. And when you look now, okay, so Henry is tied up. You got Ryan Tannehill in, who just turned his whole career in that team around, replacing Marcus Mariota. That AFC South, such a fascinating division. We talked about Deshaun Watson with Houston. Of course, you had that trade, DeAndre Hopkins gone, David Johnson in. The Colts, you had Phil Rivers. Was his last year with the Chargers, was that the decline? Can he rebound? And the Jacksonville Jaguars sort of just fluttering around there. When you look at the AFC South, like it really seems like a pick'em to me, at least a three-horse race. What do you think?
Yeah, and I don't rule out the Jaguars finding their way out of the weeds now that Tom Coughlin is gone, and they're going to give Gardner Minshew a full and fair opportunity to be the starting quarterback from the beginning of the season. Although, you know, they have purged some guys from that roster, I don't think we completely write them off, although most people would put them at spot number 32 on a full league power rankings. For the other three teams, you know, the Colts are getting a lot of buzz because of Phillip Rivers, but Phillip Rivers was not great last year. Phillip Rivers had those back-to-back primetime games where he had seven total interceptions. I can't wipe that out of my brain no matter how hard I try, but he's got a great offensive line, and he's got weapons around him. And it'll be very compelling to see what the Colts are able to do with that. The Texans are still the Texans with Deshaun Watson, who's one of the best players in the NFL. And for whatever reason, he gets overlooked when we start talking about the best quarterbacks in the league. And, you know, the Titans keeping those key pieces after they ended up being the best of the four teams and getting to the AFC Championship. The key for the Titans is going to be keeping Tannehill and Henry healthy. They've now made the financial investment. Now they have to keep them healthy. That was the problem with Tannehill in Miami. In 2016, when he started to finally fulfill his potential and emerge as a great quarterback, it wasn't his fault. He took a low hit from Calais Campbell, and it messed up his knee. They didn't do the ACL repair then. They thought they could roll the dice on it, and then the ACL went the following year in training camp. That's when they had the Jay Cutler year, and it all fell apart for Tannehill after that in Miami. But he's got to stay healthy. If he stays healthy and if Henry stays healthy as well, then that team can be very, very good. But, you know, everybody's 100% going into the season. But we know once they start hitting and once they start playing games, you're going to have guys who get injured, and that's going to have a major impact on how a season unfolds.
Mike, we're all refreshing social media to see about this mysterious Washington story that's looming. I know you probably just don't want to speculate, but is this story as big as we all think it's going to be coming out in the next couple of days from the Washington Post?
Let me tell you what I know about this and how this all kind of came to me. It was Sunday, the 5th of July. I caught wind of just a general sense that one of the three minority owners of the franchise is sufficiently dissatisfied that there was some sort of an effort to get in touch with disgruntled former employees to just stir up trouble, generally speaking, and that the minority owners weren't happy with the team, with the direction of the team, with the management of the team by Daniel Snyder. And I was never able to find out anything specific. I was never able to get to any details of what former employees may or may not know. And every major organization has former employees who left under circumstances where they would be categorized as disgruntled. And the more disgruntled someone is, the more suspect their story ultimately is. So I haven't gone down that rabbit hole at all. But what I did find out just by making a couple of phone calls that day was that two of the three minority owners have been trying to sell and have not been able to find a buyer. The Washington Post confirmed that as to two of the minority owners, threw in the third one. There are only three of them, all three who own roughly 40% of the team, trying to get out. Now, where it's gone from there, the Washington Post reportedly has something that is queued up and ready to land. And there's all sorts of speculation about the details. And who knows, it may ultimately be even more worthless than Al Capone's vault. But but there definitely is a sense of anticipation that something is out there. And I think it's this process of gathering the information and maybe reporters talking to other people in the media that they know about this story that has caused this thing to get to the point where there is widespread anticipation that some sort of shoe is going to drop on the organization, and it's going to create a huge mess, and we're just waiting to see what may happen.
In conversation with Mike Florio from NBC Sports Pro Football Talk. Mike, with training camps, over a week away, I guess, right? Coming up with and teams hoping to get everybody in, healthy, stay healthy. And in Philadelphia, looks like there's going to be no fans allowed. New York, I believe, the same. Is that? Do you think that's going to be the league trend? Baltimore had said before, if they do have fans, they'd keep it at about maybe 14,000. What's your best guess at this point that everybody is just going to have to go with one way? Like, are we going to see some stadiums allowed to have fans and others not? Or will the league, do you think, mandate that, okay, it's either some or none for everybody?
Well, remember early on when the pandemic first kicked in and the league was moving toward the off-season programs, the league's approach was whatever one can or can't do, then all have the same rules. And if one facility can't be opened, if one coaching staff can't be present, then we want equity to exist among all 32 franchises, and that's the way they proceeded. With fans in stands, I think they realize there's too much money to be made or money to not be lost by having a set of rules that is essentially whatever you're allowed to do in your locality is what we're going to do. And I think that's the way this is going to go. So depending upon what the current status of the virus is in a given city or state at any given time, that's going to drive whether and to what extent someone is allowed to go to a game and how much of a capacity is there. The Patriots expect 20% capacity at their games, and maybe they'll be able to pull it off because Boston isn't a hotspot right now. But in places like Houston and Dallas and Miami and L.A., it's laughable to suggest that within the next month and a half, it'll be in a position where fans can attend those games. So I think that's how it's going to work. And, you know, the real concern is July 28th is when training camp opens. But for some of these teams, when you work backward on the schedule as to when players can show up, in Houston, the rookies are due to report on Saturday, and they're going to have their COVID-19 test on Sunday and start conditioning 2 days later. And these are guys who have never been in the building because of the off-season program being lost due to the pandemic. Houston is one of the biggest hotspots in the world right now. There's a real level of concern within the NFL Players Association about telling those draft picks and those undrafted rookies who are under contract, yeah, go ahead, show up for work in one of the worst places in the world to be as it relates to COVID-19 right now. So, you know, these are all things that are in this giant stew that the league and the union are trying to work out on an expedited basis. And I think they've been spinning their wheels this week because all these decisions are driven by when the deadline actually arrives. Well, the deadline is arriving. Today, tomorrow, they need to get this worked out. And one of the things they need to get worked out is whether or not they're going to subject these rookies to having to show up in hotspot places for, the next 5 months. Because once they're in, that's it. They're there. And it just really, because of the way the pandemic has unfolded in the various cities, it makes it harder to envision the NFL pulling this off, but we're all hoping that it can.
Mike, we know that the NFL has this contingency plan of moving the schedule back, moving the Super Bowl back, switching around bye weeks to kind of push things back. But what would facilitate that for the NFL not to start on time at this point? Obviously, the pandemic will dictate, but what would it would take for the NFL to not start after Labor Day?
Well, I think what would have to happen is that there are so many guys who test positive. There are guys who slip through the cracks because there was a belief back in May, right after the draft, when everyone was feeling good about the fact that, hey, we pulled off the draft, we pulled off free agency, everything's working out our way. There was a belief that the testing would have advanced to the point where you could get a rapid response test, 15, 30 minutes. You could test every day. It wouldn't be putting a strain on the resources available to the general public. That's not the way it is now. How are you going to properly test everyone? How are you going to have confidence that anyone who gets into the building is negative for the virus? And then they're taking a huge leap of faith on this notion that, and they firmly believe this, we're going to find out whether or not it's true, when you have 11-on-11 football, played either in a dome with a very high ceiling or an open-air environment, it's going to be very difficult to transmit the virus from one guy to the next. So I think it just depends on what kind of outbreaks we see. And will there be so many guys who test positive that teams just can't proceed? And will they just have to shut it down? And the way the schedule was set up, when you look at the games that are due to be played week one, I think the goal was and the intent was they're going to go full steam ahead with week one and then reassess, because weeks two, three, and four are the ones that can be moved around and the ones that can be delayed. I think week two is the week where every team that plays has the same bye week, so they could just move every game from week two to when the two teams who were supposed to play have their byes and just treat week two as a collective bye for the entire league if they need to take a week off. And then weeks three and four could be tacked on to the end of the season. These are all the things that are built to the schedule, but it's all premised on going forward with week one. And in May, it looked like, yeah, sure, they'll be able to pull off week one. Here we are, middle of July, and I think, you know, it's a toss-up as to whether or not they can pull off week one.
Mike, where does it get to a point where, I know the NFL wants to go forward, but if high-profile players in the league test positive, Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers, and they're unable to play for 1 or 2 weeks and the NFL still wants to go, when does that jeopardize the integrity of the game?
Well, remember a couple of seasons in the 80s. I don't know how old you guys are, but 1982, 9 games were lost due to the strike. They still finished the season. They had a tournament of 8 teams per conference, and Washington won the Super Bowl, and no one ever tried to attach an asterisk to that conclusion to the season. And then 5 years later, another strike wiped out a week, and then there were 3 weeks of replacement players. They went out and found 28 teams of guys who were willing to cross the picket line and play football until that pressure was so much that the players, the regular players, decided to end the strike. And, you know, it created situations where the teams that had better replacement players had better playoff positioning, and maybe some teams should have been in the playoffs who didn't get in because they had crappy replacement teams, et cetera. Washington won the Super Bowl again, and nobody puts an asterisk on that. So whatever happens, however it happens, if they get the games in, and they'll move heaven and earth to replace players who test positive. They get the games in, whether it's 256 or whether it's 156, whether they lose half of the season, whatever it is, if they crown a Super Bowl champion, that trophy goes into the case and no one's ever going to say boo about it. I think that's the attitude and that's the mindset. The real question is this. We saw how all major sports got shut down with one positive test result for Rudy Gobert on March 11th. If a player or a coach, God forbid, die of COVID-19, what happens? Is that the thing that pulls the plug on this effort by the NFL to get the games in? Or, you know, are we so desensitized to all the deaths that's happened and all the mayhem that's occurred because of the virus that if it happens, people just shrug and the NFL keeps going? To me, that's a litmus test that I hope we don't get to. But I think that's going to be the one thing that would potentially derail it, short of an outbreak that completely decimates rosters and just prevents teams from playing, like some of these MLS teams that have had to drop out of the tournament that they're conducting. If and when there is a death, that's going to create a real question and a ton of PR pressure on the league to just say, we have to try this next year.
Right. And hopefully it doesn't get to that. Mike, last one for you, for me. You mentioned the draft going off well as it could, a virtual draft. But college football, the season still very much in flux. They've said, okay, we're going to have just conference games, however that makes things better. But what if college football doesn't happen? How does that affect the NFL draft? Because you would, or if it's very short, because you'd have players who really, okay, you got a year older, but you didn't play football. I wonder, I don't know if you have any sort of idea, but how would that affect next year's NFL draft, which, outside of replenishing the league with new players, is a big moneymaker?
Well, the draft still happens, right? And maybe it makes the draft even more intriguing because nobody really knows what to expect from guys who didn't play at all in the 2020 season, but it makes it even more of a crapshoot. You know, it was more of a crapshoot this year because the pro day workouts and the private workouts weren't able to happen due to the pandemic, but it still happened, and it was the highest rated draft ever because it was all we had by way of sports between the months of March and July. They'll still have a draft. And, you know, college football has been pondering the possibility of moving their season to the spring and they reportedly asked the NFL about whether or not they'd move the draft if that's what happens, and the NFL has said we're not moving the draft. Well, college football is not going to move to the spring then, because all of the draft-eligible players, and there will be a lot of them, they're going to say, see you later. We're not hanging around for football in the spring. We're getting ready for the draft. So, yeah, the draft still happens, even if college football season doesn't. And I really do think that college football is in much greater jeopardy than the NFL, because there's so many teams, there's so many players, and they're young. They're not going to be as conscientious as the NFL players would be, and it's going to be very hard to, number one, avoid outbreaks, and number two, justify that added risk, that health risk you're putting on top of guys who aren't getting paid.